This is VOA News reporting by remote. I'm Michael Brown. Dozens of people were killed, more than 100 injured, in a stampede at a religious festival bonfire in northern Israel on Friday, according to medical officials. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu called it a great tragedy, saying everyone was praying for the victims. The stampede, one of the deadliest civilian disasters in Israeli history, occurred during the celebrations of the Lag BaOmer at Mount Meron. Tens of thousands of people, mostly ultra-Orthodox Jews, gather each year to honor Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochi, a second century mystic who is buried there. Witnesses said people were trampled in a tightly packed passageway, some going unnoticed until the public address system sounded an appeal to disperse as crowds packed the Mount Meron slope in defiance of the COVID-19 warnings. The tomb is considered to be one of the holiest sites in the Jewish world, and it is an annual pilgrimage site. Brazil has become the second country in the world to top 400,000 COVID-19 deaths, despite some recent signs of containment of the virus. Local health experts had celebrated the recent decline of cases and deaths, but many fear more gruesome days could be ahead when winter hits the southern hemisphere. April is already Brazil's deadliest month of the pandemic, with thousands of people dying at crowded hospitals. About 100,000 people lost their lives in Brazil in only 1 month. For more news, please join us at voanews.com or the VOA mobile app. Via remote, this is VOA News. The United States, which has sent emergency aid to India, wants to quickly help the country increase its oxygen capacity to treat patients suffering from COVID-19, according to a U.S. official. A first military plane loaded with equipment, including nearly 1 million rapid screening tests and 100,000 N95 masks, arrived early Friday in New Delhi. The shipment is part of a more than $100 million support plan. The United States announced on Monday that it will provide other countries with 60 million doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine, which is not authorized for use here in the U.S. The White House said U.S. troops and equipment are leaving Afghanistan days ahead of the official start of the planned withdrawal, marking the beginning of the end of America's longest war. A White House spokesman said the drawdown will be deliberate and conducted in a safe and responsible manner that ensures the protection of the forces, acknowledging if potential adversaries attack the troops, they will defend themselves. Also Thursday, a NATO official confirmed to VOA that some of the 7,000 troops sent to Afghanistan as part of the multinational Operation Resolute Support have also left the country. During President Biden's address to a joint session of Congress Wednesday night, he said the troops sent to Afghanistan to get terrorists who attacked us, adding justice was served. The planned troop withdrawal comes as a new quarterly U.S. report documented a staggering 82% increase in insider attacks on Afghan government security forces in the first quarter of this year, resulting in 115 personnel killed and 39 wounded. The Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction reported Taliban insurgents posing as Afghan police or military personnel are behind most of the insider attacks. The Islamic militant group Hamas has rejected Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas' decision to cancel the first elections in 15 years, calling it a coup with no popular support. In his announcement early Friday, Abbas cited a dispute with Israel over voting in East Jerusalem, but delaying the elections will likely spare his divided Fatah party another embarrassing defeat. The elections were set for May 22nd. For more news, please join us at voanews.com. I'm Michael Brown reporting by remote, VOA News.
Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 30th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Namibia public broadcaster workers vow to continue their strike.
The board of NBC, the national broadcaster, has agreed to a certain amount of money percentages. When the date for the signature of the agreement arrived, they suddenly abandoned the agreement.
Zimbabwean takes talks of abuses during COVID-19 lockdowns. Nigeria's capital is on high alert over fresh Boko Haram threats. Sudan ratifies Women's Rights Convention, but with exceptions. And Malawi's Supreme Court abolishes the death penalty.
An effective punishment is life imprisonment, not death penalty. There's also no evidence anywhere in the world that the death penalty has contributed to a reduction in murders or killings.
And displaced children in the Central African Republic face forced recruitment and gender-based violence. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Workers at the public broadcaster, the Namibian Broadcasting Corporation, the NBC, say they will continue their strike action until all their demands are met. The workers embarked on the strike last week following a stalemate during negotiations with senior management officials over an 8% pay raise, transportation, and increase in medical and accommodation allowances. But officials say the state broadcaster does not have the funds to meet the workers' demand. Job Muyaro, Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers, tells VOA's Peter Clotty the strike will continue.
This strike is due to the deadlock on the negotiation. So the board of NBC, the national broadcaster, has agreed to a certain amount of money percentages and then set a date for the signature. When the date for the signature of the agreement arrived, they suddenly just abandoned the agreement. Of course, they didn't want to sign the agreement for which they have negotiated and agreed only for signature. Therefore, the workers are on strike in the issue of demanding that their salary negotiation must be finalized in good faith. That is where we are today.
Now, but Job, the chairperson of the Namibia Broadcasting Corporation, Lazarus Jacob, says the workers who are on strike may be risking a hostile working environment by continuing the strike in spite of the ongoing negotiations. How do you respond to that?
I think what he says is something that he is talking from his own mouth, sucking from his fingers, because the strike is a legal strike. The strike has followed the legal procedures in terms of our Labor Act. That's not an illegal strike. He should not come here and try to confuse the public and listeners, the worldwide, to think workers has been done these things without a negotiation. We have negotiated and we have gone through a deadlock and we have got the striking rules that we have put for ourselves, including the employer, him himself, has signed for the striking rules. They have signed for it. They know we have presented them with the certificate of unresolved dispute. There is nothing illegal. There's not an illegal strike. So what he's talking is completely a lie.
Well, Job, subsidy that the national broadcaster received from the government has been reduced by 62%, and revenue generated by the NBC fell by more than 50%, some people are saying. Now, this makes the demand for an 8% increase and an increase in transport and accommodation and medical aid allowances demanded by the public workers very difficult for management of the NBC to accept. What do you say to that?
What you are saying does not hold water. The budget has been cut, but recently, last month, the managers has given themselves performance bonuses that has ranged up to 2.7 million, while they know the broadcaster does not have money. Is that true? Is that convincing to workers, or even for us as trade unionists? Last week, you pay yourself a performance bonus of 500,000 per manager, and now you are saying you don't have money to increase the workers that are doing the actual work. I think somewhere there is a flaw in the story of telling the truth. So we must be honest. If you think the company does not have money. Why do you want to go to a stage where you want to give managers only performance bonuses that goes up to 2%?
That was Job Muyaro, Secretary General of the National Union of Namibian Workers. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotte from Windhoek. Malawi Supreme Court has banned the death penalty, ruling it unconstitutional because it negates the right to life. Some Malawians hailed the ruling, while others denounced the decision as removing a major deterrent to serious crimes. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The landmark ruling Wednesday came after an appeal from a convicted murderer. In its judgment, the court said Malawi's constitution respects the right to life and said the death penalty negates that right. The court emphasized the sanctity of life, saying without right to life, other rights do not exist. The court also ordered the resentencing of all cases where the death penalty was handed down. Court records show that 27 people are under a death sentence in Malawi. Michael Kayata is executive director for the Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation in Malawi. He says he entirely welcomes the ruling.
For us, an effective punishment is life imprisonment, not death penalty. There's also no evidence anywhere in the world that the death penalty has contributed, you know, to a reduction in murders or killings.
But critics like social commentator Humphrey Mvula say the court's decision may lead to acts of mob justice.
Because those that will be aggrieved at a particular time, the spontaneous action will be, even if we catch this person who has killed this person, he is not going to die. So individuals would rather see that person die on the spot, realizing that if he goes to court, the best judgment the court can administer will be basically a life sentence.
President of Malawi's Association of People with Albinism has similar concerns. Ian Simbota says without the death penalty, the government will not be able to deter attacks on albinos and people will start punishing perpetrators on their own.
And the reason is not going to be the judgment. The reason is going to be government systems' failure to respond to security concerns of persons with albinism. Because what is there is, if the government is failing to be proactive on these issues, people will find a way, because we persons with albinism are not safe.
The death penalty has long been mandatory in Malawi for those convicted of murder or treason and optional for rape. However, according to Amnesty International, Malawi last carried out an execution in 1992 when 12 people were hanged. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
Sudan's cabinet this week ratified a United Nations treaty on the rights of women, but critics note the Council of Ministers declined to affirm certain rights that would give Sudanese women true legal equality with men. Naba Muhideen reports from Khartoum.
Sudan's Ministers' Council has ratified the United Nations 1979 Convention on the Elimination of All Forms of Discrimination Against Women, CEDAW. However, the majority male council declined to endorse the notion that women are equal with men at all political and social levels and have equal rights in marriage, divorce, and parenting. Women's rights groups criticize this reservation and say they will not accept them. This is Ehsan Fagiri, the chief of the initiative No for Women's Repression. Fagiri says the transitional government tends to lower the ambitions of Sudanese people and women particularly. She says ratifying the convention with reservation of acts like those in Article 2 contradicts the goal of the convention. As the article concerns equality, it means that the government doesn't want women to have equality with men in the local legislation. As women, we will not accept that from the transitional government. In late 2018 and early 2019, Sudanese women took prominent roles in public demonstrations against longtime President Omar al-Bashir, who was ousted in April 2019. Last year, some Sudanese women received international awards for their involvement in the democratic change in Sudan. The post-Bashir transitional government endorsed some principles of human rights and women's rights last year, but female activists such as Inas Muzammil are now doubtful the government is willing to enact real reforms. She says ratifying the CEDAW Convention with reservation of three fundamental articles caused anger among their women and activist communities. It made them skeptical about the government's willingness to make a real change in Sudanese women's situation. especially given that the women have equally participated with men in the Great December Revolution and expected the transitional government to take this chance and make the change. Some other Muslim-majority countries like Saudi Arabia have reserved some acts when ratifying the 1979 Convention. The Convention gives joining countries the right to carve out some exceptions to the rights spelled out in the document, although not the fundamental rights like Sudan reserved. Political analysts like Walid Zakaria think the transitional government of Sudan is between a rock and a hard place on women's issues. Walid says the transitional government ratified the convention and made reservation on some articles following some other Islamic countries' approach, as it might be fearing the reaction of the conservative and extremist streams and want to improve its image for the international community at the same time. Meanwhile, the Sudanese government this week also ratified the 2005 Protocol on the Rights of Women in Africa, known as Maputo Protocol. The two conventions are expected to be approved by the Sovereign Council that serves as the current top authority in Sudan. Neba Muhideen for VOA News, Khartoum, Sudan.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, April 30th. Human rights groups in Zimbabwe say the government has frequently violated people's basic rights since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. The groups presented their findings on Thursday at a partial virtual meeting with officials in the capital, Harare. Columbus Mavunga reports.
At the meeting, rights groups presented a report they call The Impact of COVID-19 on Socioeconomic Rights. The report chronicles how Zimbabwe's government has violated human rights since COVID-19 lockdowns started in March 2020. Calvin Fambirai, executive director of Zimbabwe Association of Doctors for Human Rights, was one of the speakers. He says the COVID-19 pandemic highlighted the gap in medical care between the haves and the have-nots in the country.
The haves were able to secure that equipment and the bedding in private facilities whose pricing was far beyond the majority poor Zimbabweans. You also notice that the right to health is also another component that relates to torture and the inhuman and degrading treatment.
On a number of occasions, Zimbabwe's doctors and nurses have gone on strike demanding adequate protective equipment and decent salaries during the coronavirus pandemic. Naomi Chakanya, a researcher at the Labour and Economic Development Research Institute of Zimbabwe, said the government must increase salaries of all its employees to motivate them.
If the government is not doing a good service in terms of providing living wages, it is also increasing its own burden in terms of providing, of then filling the gap of decent work deficits by providing social protection. So it is in the best interest of the government to ensure that the majority of workers, the public sector workers, enjoy decent work.
The government pleaded bankruptcy whenever its workers asked for a review of its salaries. An average civil servant in Zimbabwe earns less than $200 per month. The workers want salaries increased to at least $500 per month to climb the poverty line. Also Thursday, Sibongile Mawuye of Zimbabwe Gender Commission said cases of teenage pregnancies have increased because of children are not going to school and are restricted to their homes.
We are worried about this, and we are working now with other partners to ensure that there is support, there's targeted support for girls who are mostly affected, because we've seen that a number of girls have actually, some of them, there's a lot of child prostitution. Because of poverty in the urban areas, we are seeing a lot of child prostitution. And that is a dent on gender equality, because these girls will never be able to rise to be leaders, also even in the political and public space.
Rights groups in Zimbabwe have previously accused the government of taking advantage of COVID-19 restrictions to stifle citizens' rights. A number of activists were arrested on charges of flouting lockdown regulations after they protested against the government's failure to provide for those affected by the lockdowns. Eric Mukuturi, Secretary of Zimbabwe Human Rights Commission, said his organization was aware of the complaints raised by the rights groups during the lockdown.
I must say, from our point of view as the commission, based on the assessments that we also carried out, and as well as the feedback we have been receiving from our stakeholders, including complaints on the human rights violations that we receive, I can confirm that the findings are credible.
Mukuturi promised no action Thursday, saying the commission is monitoring the situation. Zimbabwe has 38,191 confirmed coronavirus infections and 1,565 deaths, according to the Johns Hopkins University, which tracks the global outbreak. Columbus Mavunga for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
Security concerns were raised among residents of Nigeria's capital, Abuja, after the governor of neighboring Niger State said Boko Haram militants had seized territory in the state. The claim made Monday this week in a widely circulated video said the Islamist group had raised its flag in the town of Kauri, abducted women for wives, and sent thousands fleeing. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
41-year-old Enoch Obemiaso is more alert this week on his daily two-hour commute from his home in Tafa Village, Niger State, to the Nigerian capital for his printing business. Niger State authorities on Monday said Boko Haram militants attacked the town of Kauri, abducted women, sent thousands fleeing, and hoisted their flag. Obemiaso says the security threat means it's not safe to drive at night. Once it's 5 o'clock, I leave here. Now we're trying to see how we can arrange ourselves to form vigilante to protect ourselves, because this is not funny. Niger State Governor Abubakar Bello said at least 3,000 locals fled Kauri when the Islamists attacked and abducted an unknown number of women. Speaking on Lagos-based Channels Television, Bello said,
I've been engaging the federal government with, and unfortunately it has now gotten to this stage that if care is not taken, nobody, not even Abuja, is safe. Kaure is less than 2 hours' drive to Abuja, so nobody is safe anymore.
Nigerian military authorities denied the claim that Boko Haram had taken any territory and assured that Abuja residents are safe. Abuja Commissioner of Police Bala Siroma this week ordered stepped-up security patrols around Abuja's schools. Armed groups in northern Nigeria have carried out a series of attacks on schools since December, kidnapping more than 700 students, according to the UN Children's Agency, UNICEF. But authorities believe most of the attacks were by criminal groups looking for ransom, not Boko Haram, which usually operates in northeast Nigeria. But Beacon security analyst Kabiru Adamu says the militants could grow the area of the attacks if not soon stopped.
Unfortunately, it's something that may expand as we go further, except if the Nigerian counterterrorism strategy is able to prevent that expansion.
Islamic State West Africa Province ISWAP militants on Sunday attacked a Nigerian military base in Mainok in northeast Nigeria's Borno State, killing at least 30 troops. ISWAP, a regional offshoot of Islamic State, broke away from Boko Haram several years ago to carry out its own attacks on Nigeria's military and civilians. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
Conflict and violence have displaced 370,000 children throughout the Central African Republic. The UN Children's Fund says among them are at least 163,000 children who were forced to flee widespread violence in the run-up to and following the December contested general election. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Protection is one of the most urgent needs as internally displaced children face many dangers from violence, armed groups, COVID-19, and associated risks. Speaking from the CAR capital, Bangui, UNICEF representative Frana Kiza tells VOA insecurity in the country is increasing as armed groups become ever more violent. One of his major concerns, he says, is the risk of children being forcibly recruited by armed groups.
The uprooted kids, limited them, sometimes some of them absolutely with no parents around, make them extremely vulnerable to these movements that we have seen in the last months to be increasing in the country.
Since 2014, Ikiza says UNICEF has been able to secure the release of more than 15,500 children from armed groups. He says 30% are girls. He says the children are given psychosocial support, taught job skills, and helped to reintegrate into the communities from which they were taken. He says the coronavirus pandemic is having serious indirect impacts on children's well-being. He says health services are disrupted, and more children are at risk of dying from vaccine-preventable diseases because of a decrease in routine immunizations. He says malnutrition has risen significantly among displaced children. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
It's time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the draws of the Confederation of African Football 2020-2021 Toto CAF Champions League and the Toto CAF Confederations Cup, which is expected to be conducted today in Cairo, Egypt. CAF Director of Competitions, Samson Adamu, will be assisted by Cote d'Ivoire legend Abdoulaye Traoré. The Toto CAF Champions League quarterfinalists are Simba SC of Tanzania, who reached the semifinals in 1974, Al Ahly of Egypt, record 9-time champions and title holders, Mamelodi Sundowns of South Africa, who were champions in 2016, CR Belouizdad of Algeria, who are appearing in the last 8 for the first time, Wydad AC of Morocco, 2-time champions and last was in 2017, Kaizer Chiefs of South Africa, who are also making their first quarterfinals appearance, Osporan Sportive of Tunisia and MC Alger of Algeria, champions in 1976. In the Toto CAF Confederations Cup, the quarterfinalists include Eibar of Nigeria, twice CAF Champions League winners, Orlando Pirates of South Africa, also CAF Champions League winners in 1995, and Confederations Cup runners-up in 2015, JS Kabylie of Algeria, Cotton Sports of Cameroon, ASC Los Jaraf of Senegal, CS Faxien of Tunisia, Raja Casablanca of Morocco, and Pyramids FC of Egypt. Staying with draws, the draw for the Beach Soccer African Cup of Nations Senegal 2021 was conducted on Thursday at the CAF headquarters in Cairo, Egypt. Khalid Nasir, head of CAF competitions, was assisted by Mohamed Fouazi, captain of the Egyptian Beach Soccer team. Both ran the draw process. Host Senegal will kick off the tournament against Gabon DR Congo on the 23rd of May 2021 from Group A. Other members of the group include Tanzania and Uganda. In Group B, Egypt, Mozambique, Morocco, and Seychelles will seek for the 2 top slots for the next round. We'll be battling it out to qualify for the next round. Salim Jamal Maungo is the coach of the Sand Beach Cranes of Uganda. He reacts to his side appearance in Group A with Senegal, DR Congo, and Tanzania.
The group stage we are in is tough. We have been facing Senegal. We have been facing Tanzania. We don't have much details about Congo. But Senegal as a host is tough, and we are hoping to be out of this group to go to the next stage.
In cricket news, Zimbabwe's Langton Rosari made history on Thursday as he became the first black African in cricket history to umpire a test match. The 35-year-old is one of the on-field umpires for the 5-day game between Zimbabwe and Pakistan that began on Thursday at the Harare Sports Club. And that's it on Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson Omale in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. Before we leave you this morning, a somewhat personal note for VOA's English to Africa service. We are saying farewell today to Negusi Megesha, who is retiring after serving as the African Division's director for 7 years. He has been with VOA for 38 years after beginning his journalism career in his native Ethiopia. Mr. Megesha has been more than a boss to us. He has been a friend and mentor to many of us. We wish him well in his new adventures away from VOA. And that's it for this Friday, April 30th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, wishing you a very good weekend.